Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You're on 101.9 Hi FM. Thank you for joining us. This is the People in Perspective show. And every week we have a special look at people issues out there where people are confronting challenges in their work lives. Maybe there's a challenge in terms of interpersonal relations with people at work. Generally, we're looking at people from a variety of angles, and we often have organizational specialists and behavioral specialists on the show to join us. And this week, we've got Elena Godley, who's come to join us, and we're going to be talking a little bit about wellness in terms of interpersonal interaction and the dynamics, and a little bit about change and dynamics between people in the workplace. Elena has got a 30-year track record of success in her field and qualified as an industrial psychologist, a counseling psychologist. She works as a master coach, organizational leadership consultant, as well as change consultant. She's among those who's pioneered coaching and really is among the few coaches to claim a track record as a professional and entrepreneur. So, Elena, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Hi, Saul. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Elena, as we were saying, you know, we were talking about when we started our interaction, there's a lot going on in the world of interpersonal things at work. The world has become such a different place ever since COVID, and people have had to adapt. Some of these things are very controversial. You know, what for you is exciting about the controversial?
I lost the last part of your sentence.
So, you know, the world has become a very different sort of place since the COVID epidemic has hit, and with robots and AI and people just changing the way that they talk to each other. The stress factor of people has also come up to play in terms of the way people self-regulate themselves and how this idea of toxicity has come up again, and resilience, all in the face of unprecedented types of stress which people have never had to deal with before. So for you, I mean, you said to me you're interested in the controversial. So, I mean, what for you is exciting about the controversial, and what is controversial to you?
Well, thanks, Saul. It's kind of given me a box to climb onto, a soapbox.
Yeah.
When I say I'm interested in the controversial, I think that I know that the theme of your show is really on wellness, looking at people, looking at productivity, looking at outcomes, looking at, as you say, the effectiveness. The world that I'm really been focusing on at the moment is the world of stress, the world of resilience, and even this big word, the world of trauma. Mm. And does this come into business? I think that what is controversial around wellness in general is that if businesses, and typically I don't want to make any sweeping statements, but for the sake of maybe just setting something up, often employee wellness is kind of pursued as if it was like a tablet that you could dispense. You're going to launch a whole lot of programs, people swallow the tablet, and you're going to have the outcome you want, which is generally for businesses, rather than wellness, their outcome is higher productivity or better opportunities to get contributions from people. The problem about that kind of thinking then is that it's generated out of a very old style, you know, like if you see human capital as maintaining the human beings in your business, the same way you would maintain machines in your business. So what do? You keep up the service record. You make sure that they've got all the right parts and that they're plugged in. So wellness programs have definitely, although they're trying to be holistic, their main objective, I think, is not disclosed and spoken about honestly. And that introduces quite a lot of controversy in terms of what kind of effectiveness they've got, what kind of returns on investment come back, what kind of take-up you have. And it largely links to this idea of, for me, what is stress and what is resilience? And are they once-off issues? And, you know, toxicity. So if you have a organizational culture where meetings, performance, the way people are engaged, the way people are discussed, the way people are valued is not in place in a healthy way, you can plug in as many employee wellness programs, financial counseling. You can give people access to therapists. You can kind of make sure that they get exercise. You can plug in a whole lot of technology in terms of these bands, you know, that you wear on your wrist. You can have social and community engagement, etc. The level of trust will be very low in the organization, because if what people really feel is that they and their level of mental health and their level of enrollment and their level of engagement is not valued, then they won't trust the process at all.
So if people are kind of made to made to feel that they're just a recipient of some kind of intervention, you know, it's like it's the corporate wellness program and here's your water bottle and let's go on the 5K run and thanks very much. Big thumbs up, you know. They tend to be a little bit disinterested about that. Basically, I think because, you know, they can sense that they're just being sold at something where it's a sort of corporate greenwashing exercise as opposed to, a sincere helping hand from somebody in corporate to say, are you actually getting better?
So I mean, that would be a worst case scenario. And I certainly would not like to leave it there, because I think the intention behind employee wellness and corporate wellness and creating a healthy working environment, the intentions are very strong. And I think there's a lot of brain power and heart power behind a lot of those interventions. But I think the key issue is, if you want a holistic intervention, it's important to understand, how does this sit within your organization in terms of the day-to-day experience of work that people have? Because that's how it will land. And if we look at stress, what is really stress in people's lives? They have financial stress, they have emotional stress, they have all the uncertainty. We're living in a really uncertain world. And the current thinking is that it's going to continue. You know, that popular term of a VUCA world is very real. So how do we keep healthy as individuals in a VUCA world? And a lot of that comes down to our ability to self-regulate. So the world of mental health, and I am a psychologist, is moving away from kind of a therapeutize or a pathologizing to a self-help kind of ethos, where people are given tools and techniques that they can use themselves to actually change the level of emotional dysregulation. So if you're feeling stressed, you can learn some exercises, not just mindfulness, because mindfulness in itself assumes that you're not stressed. The way the brain works is that if you are super stressed, your ability to be calm and to sort of contain your thoughts is very compromised. So learning how to move into your body, giving people tools so that they can help themselves rather than making them dependent on external structures like therapists or counselors or training programs or group away days. You know, in Israel specifically, and this there's a very strong focus because the age of the workforce tends to be much younger than in other parts. There's a big focus on wellness, but it's very much around structurally implementing a ethos of it's important to see your work and your life in balance. And most companies in Israel, especially the high tech companies, which pay a lot of money, and one could say their assets are expensive, and their the cost of acquiring those assets is expensive, is most companies have a mandatory at least 2 days off a month. But the problem with that is if you don't have an idea of how to keep yourself healthy, you might use those 2 days to do extra shopping or surf the net. Or if you're already using maladaptive coping strategies like alcohol or pornography or any kind of negative ways of helping yourself feel better and cope with stress, you'll just consume those days in doing those things. So there's a lot of risk. And in order to get truly effective outcomes from employee wellness, it has to be approached in a multi kind of layered way.
It's, you know, these ideas of, you know, sort of providing people with a sort of capability to do things themselves. You know, if you were to introduce an intervention, say, as a scenario, in the workplace, you know, what leverage do you have as a facilitator to actually bring some of these tools in? Normally, there's, you know, in any HR team, you've got this, you've got psychologists who work as HR professionals, and then you've got, you know, the wellness people, and more companies are bringing in a wellness person to actually come in and do this. You know, but what kind of leverage do you actually have? You know, where, you know, can you actually sort of come in and, you know, deliver a workshop and say, these are some tools that you can use? And how do you make sure that people keep doing them when you're not there anymore?
So a long time ago, Stephen Covey said, the way we see the problem is the problem.
Yeah.
So in terms of leverage, again, I go back to, I guess, the first question that an HR team should ask the executive team in the business is what is successful outcome? What is the successful outcome we're pursuing here with employee wellness? Can we put that into words? Never mind into some sort of measurable, but can we put it into words? And when I've tested it, generally it comes down to most people and most executive teams saying, can we change or improve the way people are feeling during feeling in their lives at the moment? Now, that's a big agenda. And can we change and improve how we're feeling at work? And most programs are saying, yes, we can, because some of the things we've spoken about do make an impact, but do they last? Can we sustain it? And even if we learn tools or we get access to resources, can we access those and call on them when we really need it, not just when it's sort of scheduled? So that means that the newest thinking is really saying we need to go beyond the programs themselves and we need to ask a different question. And that question is, what does a resolved stress response look like for a human being? How do we reestablish safety and reestablish resilience and give people a sense that we are have got some control over our emotional experience in the world? So, and although we have a high tolerance for discomfort, there's a lot of people talking about it at the moment, and often I'm struck when I interview CEOs, they will say things to me like, look, I find that I can just keep going. I've got an incredible high tolerance and a high level of motivation. But I don't think the people around me are like that. And it's an interesting point, because if I ask that CEO, What does it mean that you've got a high tolerance for discomfort? Does that mean you're switched off, that you actually don't know how much stress and what's really going on? Because if you're not in touch with it, it's generally going to be visible to everybody around you. Mm. So if you're not regulated and you think you're just powering and powering and powering, the quality of the way you're holding meetings, the way you're expecting things, the way you're engaging people is going to be is going to start being manifested.
Mm.
And what you become is a kind of stress magnet yourself. So being switched off to your own level of stress is not a healthy thing.
So it's the encouragement of, of self-regulation sounds like, where you're going with that. It's like, you are building a new schema for the person where they actually know how to actually enact within themselves a new way of behaving. So you sort of people change their behavior. This is the age-old question you were talking about earlier, to say, CEOs or, leadership people, they always say, oh, well, how on earth are you going to get somebody to change the way that they behave? If this is like the total impossible question that they seemingly at a leadership level always ask, is that how do we actually get people to change? And I think it's a very intricate process that you are describing, which it looks at a whole range of things. Change management comes in to some extent there, but to actually say, to get somebody to change the way they do things involves a few different things. And we're just going to go to a short ad break and we'll be back shortly.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're on 101.9 High FM, and thank you for joining us. If you've just joined us, this is the People in Perspective show, and we are having a fascinating conversation about how to implement the changing of behavior in the workplace, and how do people actually decide, or when do they decide to change who they are in order to change the behavior? CEOs, Ilana, I don't know how many times in the past you've ever come across this. You were saying to me that communication is a sort of a very big part of this process. How does, where does that come into play?
There is an understanding that communication styles and communication skills lead to the quality of employees' experience.
Mm.
So if I learn the skills of nonviolent communication, and I'm able to have conversations in a way that people feel that they're heard and valued, and I feel that I'm heard and valued, and we can connect, then we're able to actually foster a workplace that is healthy. And that's what employee wellness is really trying to do. And that will lead me back to the idea of employee resilience.
Yes.
The question of, what is the connection between employee wellness and resilience? And is there a connection? Mm. So the interconnection really is that resilience, every human being is programmed for survival. We're actually built like that by the creator of the world and of us.
Mm.
And at a level, our bodies are the most important resource we have, because when we feel unsafe, it's because our autonomic nervous system is giving us messages. And our autonomic nervous system collects messages from three places internally. So if we are totally activated, our heart is beating fast, and we're very, very worked up, that would be a source. Interpersonally, how does it feel when this person talks to me. And it's got nothing to do with words. Our autonomic nervous system does not listen to words. It's based on neuroception. And it is constantly like a guard marching around trying to understand, is this safe or is this dangerous? Mm. And so because our autonomic nervous system controls our primary nerve, our vasovagal nerve, which is the 10th cranial nerve, affects the way that we speak. It affects the way that we sound to each other when we are stressed, mm. aggression, or even just hyperactivation
yes.
creates panic in mm. the other person. So employee wellness, we co-regulate each other. If you have in your family, in your workplace, a situation where you have high levels of dysregulation, mm. it is not possible for people around you not to be affected by that. Mm. So the return to actually teaching people basic understanding of self-regulation means, how am I doing right now? Am I really in a place? What's going on in my body? Mm-hmm. Am I feeling a pain in my chest? Is my heart beating faster? Tune into the tone of your voice. Tune into the clenchedness of your jaw, because all of that is actually being communicated to the human beings around you.
Mm.
And that co-regulation or co-dysregulation can never be counted, no matter how much money you put into wellness programs.
Mm.
If on an ongoing basis we're making each other unwell by adding to the stress, then it's kind of a vicious cycle. And the unintended consequences of not focusing on how we can actually build greater connection, because our autonomic nervous system is responsible for our connection mm. between people.
Mm.
When we are dysregulated, we can't connect. What does that mean? It means that I can be sitting with you, but I can't feel you. I can't see you, Saul. I can't understand you. And although I listen to your words, we get into a situation where we're in disagreement, but we're actually not communicating.
So you're kind of talking at each other and not to each other, and you actually
Correct.
Are. And the cortisol and all the chemicals that come with the high levels essentially
exactly.
blocks off the receptors that you would have in order to actually feel what somebody's saying, because this is what you were saying to me the other day, is that people often communicate, they don't say what they're actually feeling and vice versa.
Well, I think vulnerability, we kind of got to, there are a few basic, a lot of the research I'm involved in and a lot of the work I'm doing now is trying to unlearn some basic ideas.
Mm.
So in terms of the leadership management area. Nothing what I'm saying is new. I'm pretty sure that everybody out there knows this and hopefully is getting a sense of, yes, of course, that's what I believe. You know, the whole area of vulnerability and vulnerability trust, being willing to own up, being willing to speak in the eye, being willing to ask for what you need. Nonviolent communication is the ability to say to somebody, this is what happened, and not in a critical way, owning up, this was the impact it had on me, and asking for what you need. So there's some skills that can be mastered around nonviolent communication, and that goes a long way to building wellness. And, you know, the World Health Organization said that we should not so much focus on the absence of stress or anxiety or disease, but more focus on the presence of joy and connection. And that's how we get to resilience, because our resilience is our ability to bounce back, our ability to actually recover when we are taken outside of our window of tolerance.
So so it's almost an investment in positivity. You know, when you started to say that, I immediately started to think of Simon Sinek, you know, where to allow those positive emotions into the equation. And make the whole interaction about that. And that is your investment, and that's the shared currency that you then have between yourself and the other person, as opposed to the disinformation. I think that's vitally important to have that.
So if I can just one last thing I wanted to land is that What the research is showing is that even when businesses and HR teams spend money on all the right kinds of training and tools and resources, if the internal things that we're talking about in terms of the culture, the climate, and the basic competency of the means of working are not in place, then all of those resources get expended on tangential things. In other words, people talk about the stress outside of work, or their financial planning outside of work, or their family issues. And those things are not integrated back into a level of value for the businesses. So it then becomes almost like a social responsibility. It's kind of like businesses doing what they think is good for the world, but not really believing that there's a return on that investment in their own micro environment.
So there's room for growth, and there's certainly things that can, good things that can help us in that space. We're going to a short ad break. We'll be back shortly.